Thank you for that prayer.
So at Willoughby, there's a series, and I've just had one previous message in it, and now today a second one, but it's called Walking It Out, and the kind of gist of that series is that a church together, as they walk the road of that the Spirit leads us in, that we walk it together, and that there are disciplines and ways of doing so. Here, this passage from Paul, that if we live by the Spirit, let us keep in step with the Spirit, from Galatians 5. And so exploring together what it means to walk it out in the Spirit as disciples of Jesus Christ, members of God's household. What I brought to this a week ago, or a couple weeks ago, is an emphasis on song. One of the ways that we walk together is we walk together in music, in song. And it occurred to me some time ago, I spent a whole year in Walnut Creek, California, and we sang contemporary music, and that there were hymns, ways that people had sung the faith over a long period of time that we weren't singing anymore. And so I thought we ought to know those a little bit. And so I started putting a list together, and I asked people, you know, what would you put on the list? And I got a couple of suggestions, but not many. And it could go on forever. I mean, this would be a series you could preach for a whole year. I started with 2 weeks ago with this one. Not a particularly familiar song, I think, anymore. All people that on earth do dwell. The tune's familiar because it's the tune of the doxology, praise God from whom all blessings flow. But I picked it because it's deeply insinuated in the history of congregations like this one, Reformed congregations. Because it goes back to a project that Calvin actually started. When Calvin wanted to figure out how to do worship, he wanted to renew worship, reform worship. He thought worship ought to be biblical. And so if worship is biblical, it ought to come from the Psalms. So he wanted to assemble a psalter, a French psalter. He hired poets. French poets to put the Psalms into French verse, and then he hired songwriters, including a guy named Louis Bourgeois from Lyon, to come and write songs. And this song has been sung ever since by Reformed people as one of the central songs of the faith, and it points to Psalm 100, right? Because that's what it's based on. And so when we looked at that, you know, that led me, that song, as I started to think about the song, I started to think about Psalm 100, looked at Psalm 100, and Psalm 100 turns out to be a whole lot more than I remembered in Psalm 100. And the center of Psalm 100, the very central verse, remember there are seven verbs. The central verb is know. Know what? Know three things. Know who God is. Know that the Lord, in the Hebrew, it would be Yahweh. Yahweh is God. And as Christians, when we read that, we say, know that the God who comes to us in Jesus Christ is God. God is not generic. God is not whatever we make up. God is the God of history and the God of Israel and the God of Jesus Christ. The second thing is, know who we are. It is He who has made us, and we are His. Or, perhaps the better translation is, and we didn't make ourselves. It is He who made us, and not we ourselves. Which is the most countercultural thought in Western culture these days. I mean, we all think we're self-made, you know, that we kind of create ourselves, that we can be whatever we want to be. That's, you know, that's deep in our DNA. But the psalm says, no, no. You exist because God made you. And God made you for God's purposes. And then, I don't know if you remember this, but I quoted from the Westminster Shorter Catechism, what is the chief end of man? What is the purpose of human life? It is to glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. At the very heart of Reformed theology is this idea that we exist to give God glory. And that's a capacious faith. That's a huge faith. That's a faith which takes in all of life to know who we are. And the third thing was to know where we are. We are his people, the sheep of his pasture. This is his pasture. We belong here. We belong here not because of something we did or because we have the right kind of theology or whatever. We belong here because God has claimed us. It is the belongingness. Belonging precedes anything we do. We belong to God because God claims us before we have done anything all in our lives. So know those three things. That's today, I want to go to another song. And I picked this song in part because when Peace Like a River, we'll sing it in a just a little bit. I picked this song because it spans the traditional and contemporary ways of worshiping these days. It's sung in contemporary worship and it's sung in traditional worship. It's a song that is popular. It's a song on which other songs have been based. It runs deep in us as worshiping people. It was written by Horatio Spafford. He's a businessman. Not a musician. He was a Chicago businessman, real estate guy. He was a good friend of Dwight Moody's. Dwight Moody was one of the first evangelists, one of the first kind of popular evangelists. And Moody started Moody Institute in Chicago. Spafford had a wife, Anna, and four daughters. Annie, Maggie, Bessie, and Tanetta. They were 14, 12, 7, no, no, 14, 7, and 4, and 18 months. He decided that Moody had was doing an evangelistic campaign in England, and he decided to join Moody in England and to take his family with him, so did Horatio Spafford. And so he booked passage on a boat to go across to England, and then at the last minute he decided he needed to do some business things, so he put his family on the boat. Off they sailed. You probably know this story. And in the middle of the Atlantic somewhere, another boat hit their boat, and it went down, and the four girls died. And when Anna got to the other side, to England, she sent a telegram back to Horatio, "Saved alone, only me." And then Horatio got in a boat himself and went to join Anna and to mourn together. And when he was in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, somewhere near where that boat went down and his daughters drowned, he wrote this: "When peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot, you've taught me to say, it is well with my soul." I don't know if Horatio Spafford knew this, but sometimes there is in the air, as it were, echoes. And his words echo the words of somebody else much earlier, Julian of Norwich, a mother of the church, a great theologian, 14th century. You know the 14th century, that was the time of plague. It was the time when something like a third of Europe died in this plague, a horrendous time. And she almost died, Julian, as a young woman. not of plague, but she was very, very sick. They had given up on her. And in the middle of the time when she almost, when people expected her to die, she had some visions. And she wrote them down. She survived, she wrote them down. And then she spent the rest of her life, she was an anchoress, you know, a set aside. She spent the rest of her life reflecting on those visions, on the gospel, and she wrote again a second time about the visions, the longer narrative, and it became a significant theological tract, and at the very center of it was one thought. Here it is. All shall be well. See how this echoes with Spafford's words? And all shall be well, she repeats it. And all manner of things shall be well. And she precedes it, actually, the sentence that goes before that, which is very important to her, is that sin, she says, is behoovely. Not a word we have anymore, behoovely, Middle English. We get behooved from it, though. And the idea is that even sin can be an instrument, even evil can be an instrument in the hands of God. If sin is behoovely, she says, and all shall be well. And all shall be well. And all manner of things shall be well. That's the gospel I want to preach this morning. For the text I'm going to turn to, Genesis. The very end of Genesis is Joseph's story. A couple of verses from, the last verse of 49 and the first verse of 50, and then I'll skip to verse 15. Here's how it goes. So when Jacob had finished giving instructions to his sons, I don't know if you know, chapter 49 in Genesis is a long poem in which all the sons of Jacob are named and things are said about them, blessings and kind of curses. Jacob drew his feet up into the bed, and he breathed his last, and he was gathered to his people, and Joseph threw himself on his father. Note that. Threw himself on his father and wept over him and kissed him. And then verse 15. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrongs we did to him?" And so they sent word to Joseph saying, now listen to the way this note, it looks like it was written by some kid to a principal. "Your father left instructions before he died. This is what you are to say to Joseph. I ask you to forgive your brothers the sins and wrongs they committed in treating you so badly. Now please forgive the sins of the servants of the God of your father." And when their message came to him, Joseph wept. And his brothers then came and threw themselves down before him and said, "We are your slaves," they said. But Joseph said to them, "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So then, don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children." And he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. So if you read fiction, I hope you do actually, good readers of fiction are sensitive readers. They begin to get how narratives go, and so it actually helps you read other things. But if you read fiction, especially if you read like mysteries or detective fiction or something, what you'll discover is that you have to see the story from the end in order to understand what was going on in the beginning, right? I mean, things in the beginning are all confusing, it's, you know, this and that, and then as it develops, finally from the end, looking back, you see how it all hangs together, or doesn't all hang together. Sometimes stories are told that don't all hang together, which is what judgment's about. you know. I used to fear God's judgment. I had this notion. I'm sure I got it as a kid. You know, the God was sitting up on this high dais, this throne, and looking down at me, and I come up, you know, with my filthy rags on, God calls out my name and then looks at me kind of down and, like, you know, glares at me. How could you have done all those things that you did? You know, kind of thing. Condemnation. But the word for judgment in the Bible, especially the Greek word, has more to do with interpretation than with condemnation. We still use it that way sometimes. And the idea is that in the end, this is why judgment is so important in biblical terms, that in the end, God tells our story. So a long time ago, I came up with an idea, but it's not biblical. I always think it should be, but and I'm not sure if I've probably told you this story before, and I'm getting old, so I keep telling it over and over again. But I've had this notion. There was a place in Chicago, actually, speaking of Horatio Spafford, there was a place in Chicago that I did a wedding once, it had this beautiful marble floor and this huge marble staircase coming down into the first floor. And I thought, you know, that's maybe what heaven's like. And so I imagined that you'd stand at the top on this kind of mezzanine, this balcony, and then your name would be announced. The archangel would say in a loud voice, Clay Leibold. And all the screens of heaven would light up. And your story is on the screen. And you look at it and you're amazed. You think to yourself, yeah, that's happened. That's exactly the way it happened. That's true. Except you've never seen it from that perspective before. Never. It looks different than it, you know, when you told your story from earth, it looked different than now that's being told from heaven. It's being told from the point of view of God, from the point of view of the end. And suddenly things that you thought were tremendously important turn out not to be important at all. And things that you thought were trivial turn out to be tremendously important. And then the video ends and all heaven breaks out in applause. And the voice comes from the throne. Well done, my good and faithful servant. That's judgment. That's, can I use the big word, the big theological word, eschatology, you know? We have to think eschatologically, which does not mean what sometimes people think it means. You take a little bit of Revelation, some of Ezekiel, a little Daniel, you know, you mix it all together, you try to figure it out, you sit there night after night poring over this at your desk, and then eventually you produce a scheme. This is the way things are going to go, and they never turn out that way. It's not what eschatology is about. What eschatology is about is having the confidence that one day we will see it from the end. And that when we do, all will be well, and all will be well, and all manner of thing will be well. Which is what the story is about, right? The Joseph story. I mean, it's a popular story. It's a great story. There's the VeggieTale version of it, in which it's played as a Western. I don't know if you've ever seen the VeggieTale thing. It's called the Ballad of Little Joe, and I see down there a lesson in facing hardships. Not exactly what the story's about, but the VeggieTales are always clever. Or, I like this one. This is Andrew Lloyd Webber, you know, Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, in which every song is sung in a different style. And so when the brothers sing, they're singing country western. And when Pharaoh sings, this is great. This is one of the great moments. I'm sorry to spoil this for you. But he comes out of his booth on a top of a high staircase, this is the way I saw it staged. And he walks out and he's in a white jumpsuit like Elvis. And he looks down at Joseph, who's supposed to tell him his dream, and he sings, "Don't be cruel." That is a moment. It doesn't have much to do with Joseph, though. The story itself is kind of ugly, isn't it? I mean, Jacob was many things. A good businessman, he was a cheat sometimes. He was a terrible father and a terrible husband. He paid favorites, you know. He had a favorite wife, Rachel. I mean, I suppose if you can talk about a favorite wife, you're already in trouble. But you remember the story when he meets Esau? He's waiting for Esau to come with his 400 men, and Esau comes riding up, he stages his family so that he has the two concubines with their children in the very front, kill them, sort of, and then right behind them, Leah and her children, and then way back, Rachel and Joseph. That's got to leave some scars. You know, and so because he has a favorite wife, he has a favorite son, Joseph, and he gives to him the coat, right, the amazing Technicolor dream coat. We used to call it the coat of many colors. I suppose in the Hebrew, you know, I looked at this again in the Hebrew, it's something like a coat of fancy stitchery, but somehow that doesn't resonate. So let's just call it the coat of many colors, right? And then he dreams, Joseph dreams, and all his dreams have to do with the whole family bowing down to him. His brothers hate him. I grew up in a family of all brothers. I understand this, you know? I was the oldest. My brothers always claimed that I was my mother's favorite, and they've never forgiven me for it, right? I mean, and then in a stunning piece of bad parenting, Jacob sends Joseph out into the field, and I always thought that he'd send him out in the field in order to bring them lunch or something, you know, attend to their needs, but that's not what he was doing. He was out there as a spy. Go out there and see what your brothers are doing. That's going to go over well, right? When they see him coming, ideas start to spin around. This story is full of kind of wisdom, you know, the kind of things that happen, you know. They start talking, and eventually the talk ends up in action, and eventually it ends up with him being sold into slavery into Egypt. And even when he gets into Egypt, you know, it doesn't go well. He's the head of Potiphar's household, and then Potiphar's wife takes a shine to him, and he repudiates her, and then she accuses him of molesting her, and he ends up in jail, and he goes to jail. And I can't imagine what an ancient Egyptian jail looked like, but I'm sure it wasn't great. And he's in this dungeon, you get this sense, without much hope, but he has a gift for, not just for dreaming dreams, but for telling dreams, of interpreting dreams. And the baker and the butler both have dreams, and he interprets them. And the butler is the one, I think, who eventually is going to go back to Pharaoh. And he says, "When you go back, tell them about me here, you know. Plead my case." And nobody does. Until the Pharaoh dreams the dream, or dreams. Fat cows, lean cows, burgeoning grain, withered grain. And Joseph interprets it, and Joseph gets put in charge of the kingdom, and he does what he suggests, his plan. He during the seven fat years, the seven good years, he accumulates stuff. He socializes Egypt in a sense. He takes it over. He insists that everybody bring their grain to him. And then when the famine comes, he's got food. And the famine spreads even up into Palestine, Canaan. And his brothers come, and you know how it goes. He plays them a little. You know, there's a little in Joseph of wanting to be vindictive about this. He plays them a little, plays them expertly. And then finally he breaks down in tears. He can't do it anymore. And he embraces them and he says, I'm Joseph. And he gives them property, a place to live in Egypt. And he brings his father, Jacob, what a reunion this is, to Egypt. And he joins him. And then this is where we picked it up. And then Jacob dies. And all the time the brothers have been thinking, Joseph's just waiting. He doesn't want to do anything while Dad's alive because he doesn't want to hurt Dad, but he's just waiting, and as soon as Jacob dies, he's going to get his, and he is the grand poobah, he's the head of everything, so he can do this, and so they write that silly little note to him, you know, that convinces nobody, a note that they absolutely make up, and when they get that note, Joseph weeps. Because they think still that he's bitter. And then they bow down before him and they offer to be their slaves. And he says to them, don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? That is, in the book of Genesis, one of the most important phrases. I don't know if you have noticed this. Marilyn Robinson, you know Marilyn Robinson? She wrote this wonderful novel called Gilead some years ago. She's written several others since then. An earlier one called Housekeeping. She's a Pulitzer Prize winning novelist and a reformed Christian, a deeply reformed Christian. And she just wrote a book on reading Genesis. And it's a book that's filled with all, I mean, for somebody that does biblical scholarship, it can be absolutely exasperating. And yet, she is such a good reader. She can read, she knows how to read narrative. She knows how to read story, you know? And she sees things that I think very few readers of Genesis have ever seen. And one of the things that she sees, she thinks this is the dominant theme in Genesis, is that God never does God-like things. Everybody's expecting God to have condemnation, to judge people. Everybody's expecting God to, you know. So Cain, let's just take Cain. Murders Abel, his brother. And you'd expect God to say, well, that's a capital offense, and somehow to put Cain to death. But instead, what does God do? He talks to Cain. He protects Cain. And when finally he loses, God in Genesis kind of loses his patience and sends the flood. At the end of the flood, what happens? The people walk off the boat, Noah and his sons and their wives and so forth. And have they changed? They haven't changed at all. It says, actually, Genesis, make sure you know this, every thought is still evil in their hearts. What's changed? Not them, but God. God says, I'm never going to do that again. And sends a rainbow. Joseph said to them, am I in the place of God? It is God who always grants grace. So in some sense, Joseph is in the place of God. Because instead of coming down in judgment, he grants them grace. You intended it to do me harm, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is being done, the saving of many lives. That's the end of the story, you know. And this, what's being suggested is that is not just the end of the story of Genesis, but the story of the universe. That in the end, it will tell a story not of judgment, but of grace. It will tell the story that Julian tells, all is well and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. Or Spafford, it is well with my soul. But understand what's being said here. It's not saying that evil is somehow good. Sometimes we you know, in an eagerness to comfort people, we use Romans 8, that all things work together for good for those who love God. And we turn it into the idea that somehow all things are good. No, all things are not good. There is evil in the world. Evil in the world is always present. Death is evil. Violence is evil. All you got to do is read the headlines. I mean, if you want to trivialize evil, just spend a little time with thinking about what's going on in Ukraine and Gaza and a dozen other places in the world, or in our streets or wherever. Evil exists. Evil is real. Sometimes, as a matter of fact, evil seems the most real thing in the world, which is what many of us believe in our hearts. We come to church and we talk about love and joy and grace and peace. And then we walk out and we say, but that's church. And the real world isn't like that. The real world is violent, take no prisoners, make sure that you're the winner. All those kinds of values which are enunciated so often in our culture and which are bought by Christians, and which Christians say, well, yeah, the church is for God, but when I'm out in the world, I'm going to behave just like everybody else, and I'm going to get mine. Cruelty, evil, is real. And this is what Joseph says, the Joseph story. And this is what Julian says. And this is what Spafford says. That in fact, that's wrong. That evil is not the most real thing in the world. The love of God is the most real thing in the world. Evil is, in its own way, an illusion. Evil is a telling of the story in a way that is false. When I was preparing for this sermon, I read a book by Dennis Turner, who is a book. It's a book about Julian. It's called Julian of Norwich, Theologian. And in the book, he's making the point that sometimes she does not get taken seriously as a theologian, but she should be, and that when we list the great Christian theologians, we should include Julian in the list. And as part of that book, he talks a little bit about Dante. Dante from Florence, you know, in Italy. Dante was writing just a little bit before Julian, same century, 14th century. And I don't know if you know the poem, but, you know, the Divine Comedy. And the Inferno is the one that most people read, which is the descent into hell. Dante and his guide, Virgil, go down into hell. And hell, you have to understand, in this poem, is functioning as a way of thinking about evil. So that as Dante goes down level by level, he meets people that he knows from his life in Florence and in that part of Italy. So they're going down, Dante and Virgil, and they come across a landslide across the path. It's actually a kind of a rock slide. I don't know if you've ever hiked in a path which has a rock slide across it. I know one like in the Lake Ann path on Mount Baker, and those are hard to do. You know, the rocks are, they go every which way. They're sharp. It's hard to get across. So they're kind of piecing their way across this landslide in hell, And Dante's thinking to himself, well, how did that happen? Where did the landslide come from? And Virgil, who doesn't know the gospel, just kind of in a vague way says something about something good came in momentarily. It was a moment in which some light entered hell. And when light entered hell, the story of hell, what is the story that hell tells? It's the story that evil is triumphant, that evil does things. That the story in hell began to fall apart. There was a landslide in hell. You know what he was thinking about? He was thinking about the Apostles' Creed. You know, that Jesus died and descended, what, into hell. And so momentarily, Jesus steps into hell, and when he does, there's a landslide in hell. It's what the Joseph story is saying, right? The guys, the brothers, they believe in the story of hell. They believe in the story that evil is the only thing that really exists. They can see nothing except evil. And so when Joseph steps into their lives when they come to Egypt to get food, when he steps in, it's like a landslide in hell, a landslide in their lives. With a cross, right? Isn't this the fundamental story? That what happens is that Jesus comes and he preaches and he heals, and there is this moment of euphoria, and everybody thinks, oh, this is the greatest thing that's ever happened. And then he's arrested, nailed to a cross, and he dies. And the two going to Emmaus are walking, talking to each other and saying to themselves, we thought he was the Messiah. We thought there was hope. But as a matter of fact, once again, the world has proven that death is ultimate, that power is ultimate, that the Romans are ultimate. And then on Easter Sunday morning, some light shines, and it's like a landslide in hell. And so when Julian says that all is well, all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well, or when Horatio Spafford writes, it is well with my soul, it is well, it is well, it is well with my soul, when he says that, when he stands at the point where his children died, it is like a landslide in hell. It is saying that is not the end of the story. Are those Amish people in nickel mines, after their daughters were killed, shot, who go to the assassin's funeral and support his wife? And nobody can figure out how that happens, because it's a landslide in hell. And every time we sing that song, it is well with my soul. Every time we say that, we let a little light in. And we say the story the world tells is not the final story. That one day we will see the story from the end. And it will be a story of hope and grace. So we pray with Horatio Spafford. O Lord, haste the day when my face shall be sight, the clouds be rolled back as a scroll, the trump shall resound, and the Lord shall descend. Even so, it is well with my soul. Pray with me, Lord God. In the midst of a world which persistently tells the story that evil wins, it is so difficult, week to week, to be able to believe and hang on to the story that evil is an illusion. That one day we will see it whole. Grant us that perspective. Grant us that faith, that hope. Grant us, Lord, that even in the midst of deep sorrow, it will be well. It will be well with our souls. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the Willoughby Church Sermon Podcast. The Willoughby Church Podcast Network also has podcasts about discipleship, the Heidelberg Catechism, and even a podcast hosted by some of the youth. You can find out more about the Willoughby Church Podcast Network by going to willoughbychurch.com.